MacCast, Saturday, May 13th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we've got a few things to talk about in this week's episode. Actually, it's been a little bit longer than a week, you may have noticed, but that just means we have a few more things to cover, and it's been a little bit slow lately with the Apple and Mac news, but we've got some good stuff to talk about this time around. We're going to talk about potential for a new product from Apple, some more details on that home speaker that we let you know about on the last episode of the MacCast. Tim Cook talks a little bit more about the Mac and Apple's plans there. We're going to get into iPads and how they are doing compared to the rest of the industry, or how Apple is doing with tablets compared to the rest of the industry. Apple wearables, we're going to talk about them sort of superseding the current reigning champion of wearables, get into a big announcement around Apple TV and video application that some of you might be excited about. And also, of course, we can't get by without some iPhone 8 rumors. There's some mapping stuff. Let's see what else we got going on here. We've got Apple stores potentially being refreshed. We'll get into that. And that manufacturing fund that Apple set up, we now know the first recipient of the money for that. We've got that. We've got more on the whole Wi-Fi location weirdness we've been talking about. I've got some great feedback from you on slaying your lightning bunnies. Going to get into the home assistant kind of stuff and help you maybe get help with your Mac. Got a question about that. And I have a great thing of the moment for you this week, something I'm very excited to share with you. So we are going to get into all of that in just a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a second and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Bitbucket. If you are a coder, if you're a programmer, if you're using any kind of code source management, and you should be, you need to check out Bitbucket, because let's be honest, code is your world. You create it, you tweak it, you lovingly obsess over it every day, and picking the right repository management is really important. You really want only the best for your code, right? That is why the team at Atlassian created Bitbucket. Bitbucket is the Git solution for professional teams helping over 5 million developers build with a purpose. Bitbucket gives teams of all sizes a free private repositories with state-of-the-art features like the world's best pull request algorithm, built-in continuous delivery, and integrations with all of your favorite tools like Docker, Amazon Web Services, and Azure. And because Bitbucket comes from Atlassian, it offers the best Jira integration available, giving your team everything you need to take your code from concept to customer. And I've used Bitbucket on several projects, and I can tell you it helped keep the team organized, it helped keep the code all together, it allowed us through the branching to set up different projects and branches and have all kinds of things going on and do it in a secure way where we could keep everything on track. And I really loved the ease of the interface. Just setting things up was incredibly easy. And for one of my projects, it was all integrated with Amazon Web Services, and that made deployment and all that sort of stuff super simple. So it's got some really unique features that I think are great, like branch permissions that let you control who on the team can perform what actions on a certain branch, a branch type, or a branch pattern. So you can really divide up your team, divide up the roles, and keep track of everything. So it makes it really great for that. Bitbucket is for the code that takes us to Mars, the code that decodes the human genome, or the code that drives your next car. So visit bitbucket.org/forthecode to start your free account. It will let you use Bitbucket for small teams of up to 5 people for completely free. There's no credit card needed, so no excuse not to try it out. That's bitbucket.org/forthecode to give it a try today. And what will your code do? Big thank you to Bitbucket and Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. We talked about on the last episode of the MacCast the rumor that Apple may finally be entering the home assistant market, that they may be bringing out a Siri device, a hardware product that will compete with things like the Amazon Echo and the Google Home, this voice assistant. And now my Echo is going to want to go off. There it goes. Sorry about that. I have these things, and I would love to have an Apple one. So I was getting pretty excited about that. We talked about some of the rumors about what it might look like. And this week we got a little bit more information, more rumors coming out about who might be building it and what's going on. The Economic Daily News claims that Apple supplier Inventec in Taiwan has been tasked with actually building the product. They are the current maker of Apple's AirPods, so hopefully they'll be able to produce the Apple Home speaker a little bit faster than they do the AirPods. I think those are still on a six-week back order. But the report is unclear if they're just going to be a component supplier or if they're handling assembly. The logic does seem to indicate that Foxconn would be the choice for doing assembly, but they have not been asked to handle that yet, so it's not really clear at this point, but it does seem like Inventec is actually going to be involved in the production of this product. Now, some of the rumored specs, if you remember, it's going to have a incredible speaker system. It sounds like it's going to sound really good. One woofer, seven tweeters. It's supposedly going to have an A8 equivalent ARM processor, so it's going to have a lot of horsepower behind it, and probably very likely will have Apple's W1 Bluetooth chip technology built into it. So it should be a pretty good technical powerhouse, and hopefully it'll have a lot of smarts behind it. Now, an interesting thing happened this week because Gadgets 360 posted an interview with Phil Schiller commenting and talking a little bit about voice assistants and the lack of screens on some of them. Now, it's not clear if Apple's offering is actually going to have a screen, but some of the things he said were interesting. He was talking about really the differences in where with a voice assistant, sometimes you want a screen and other times you don't. For example, when you're in the car, you really don't want to be looking at a screen, so everything has to be voice driven. But he mentioned, hey, if I'm wanting to get directions on and I want to see a map, a screen could be very useful for that. Or in photography applications, if you're talking about, you know, trying to view images or return images back, obviously you're going to want a screen to be able to see those. Those aren't going to work very well in voice. And he said games was a big area where voice combined with screens would be a better experience. And he commented that he hadn't really seen any good voice-driven, you know, voice-only driven games. And I thought, you know, that's probably correct. I haven't seen many of those or heard about many of those, but they probably exist, and it's just a matter of, you know, creativity. I think someone out there is going to create a great sound, audio, voice-driven game for some of these voice assistants. So I think it could be done. Obviously, with screens, you have more options and things like that. It could get very interesting combining voice assistant with a screen. As a matter of fact, Amazon released their first product in that area this past week. And I'll just comment on it. I don't think it's a very attractive product, and I'm not really sure how much is being added to it. Time's going to tell on that, so it's hard to tell because they just announced that product. But Apple and Phil Schiller seem to be interested in the idea of combining voice assistants and screens as well. So they were talking about that. He also mentioned that screens remain important, will become more important, rather, as the power of the voice assistant's artificial intelligence grows. So as these things get smarter, Phil's saying, hey, they're going to actually need displays to go along with them. And that got me thinking about this kind of idea of, does the display, though, have to be physically part of the voice assistant product? Does it have to be part of that home speaker product? And Apple's in this unique position where most of us have other devices. We have an iPhone or an iPad or maybe an Apple TV, a Mac, something that actually already has a screen attached to it. So what would happen if you combined the voice assistant speaker technology with another device? In a lot of ways, kind of using the iPhone as an accessory or your Apple TV as an accessory to that voice assistant. And then dividing, as Phil was talking about, those times when you may or may not need a screen. So falling back on trying to do as much as you can with the voice, but when you do want a screen experience, what about a continuity-like feature where the speaker can actually hand that job off to the screen when it's appropriate? So the voice assistant can say, hey, I found your directions. Would you like me to read them back to you? Or if it's more convenient, I can bring it up on one of your screens and you can say, yeah, show that to me on my iPad or my iPhone or even my Apple TV. That could get really interesting. And that wasn't something that Schiller brought up, but it's something I started thinking about. It's like Apple has the ability to kind of do some things that I think other manufacturers in the space don't do. So what do you think about that? I'd be curious to hear some of your feedback. Now, Bloomberg is reporting that the Siri speaker, as they're calling it, is already being tested by Apple employees in their homes. That's been going on for several months. So it's looking like we are getting to the point where this is going to be a product that we're going to see very soon. The question is going to be when. I think WWDC is one of those logical places where Apple might show this off. Now, it's not clear, again, if Apple's going to be having a screen on their offering, but you remember when we talked about this last time, Sonny Dixon, who is one of the sources of these rumors, believed that it was going to look sort of almost Mac Pro-like in that it may have touch controls, I think he mentioned, but not anything like a full display. And I don't expect Apple's, at least first offering, to have a display attached to it. But for sure, no matter what, the artificial intelligence, the AI, the Siri smarts, that's going to have to be very good. Siri's going to have to do a lot more with voice response, which I think is going to be good all the way around. I think if those benefits come across to our iOS devices, I think that's going to be good. And Apple has been making a big commitment in artificial intelligence. And one other thing that happened this week, although it won't be probably in there in time to improve the Apple Home speaker, is we found out they confirmed that they acquired a company called Lattice Data. And they are an artificial intelligence technology company that is focusing on something called dark data. And what is dark data? I wanted to know myself because I didn't really understand what that was. Dark data is unstructured data that is typically hard for a computer to analyze. So when you think about most data like facts and figures, say sports scores or the weather, that's structured data. You know about it. You know how to categorize it. You know how to deal with it. Dark data is unstructured data. It doesn't have categories associated with it. So computers, they have a little bit harder time analyzing and processing that, and that's where artificial intelligence can kind of come in and help out. And I guess Lattice supposedly has technology that makes sense of this unorganized dark data, specifically in things like images and in text. I'm assuming by text meaning speech and things that you might be asking or querying about. And so Apple obviously thinks this company has some technology that they could benefit from and roll into and have acquired them. So I think, you know, as much as people complain about Siri, I think it's getting better. And I think we're going to see some huge leaps and bounds, especially if we see products like this Apple Home speaker coming out this year. And only time's going to tell on how good this stuff is going to be. But I'm starting to look really forward to this year's WWDC, because it's sounding like we're going to get a lot of pretty big announcements coming up. It's been slow, right, in the beginning of the year here. There hasn't been a lot happening, and Apple hasn't been telling us a lot. We've been expecting products, but we haven't seen anything. Hopefully, we're on the cusp of seeing those. As we've discussed, Apple's iPad business continued to see significant declines last quarter. If you remember, they went from 10 million iPads sold in the second quarter of 2016 to just 8.9 million in the second quarter of 2017. This is from Apple's last earnings results call. The earnings were also down 3.8 billion last quarter compared to about 4.4 billion in the same quarter last year. But As bad as that sounds, Apple is not the only company actually dealing with shrinking tablet demand. IDC came out with their latest worldwide quarterly tablet tracker report for the first quarter of 2017, and they found that the entire tablet market had shrunk about 8.5%. Now, Apple still saw the largest year-over-year decline of any major tablet makers, according to the IDC report. They were down 13% year-over-year, while Samsung was down just 1.1%. And as a matter of fact, the low-cost tablet maker, Huawei, actually was a pretty big winner in the first quarter. They saw almost 32% growth from last year. So they did pretty well. IDC is citing consumers being less likely to upgrade their tablets, greater smartphone dependency, and general disinterest by consumers in the tablet form factor as the reasons for the steady decline. Now, on the good news side, Apple still maintained the largest share of the tablet market, coming in at just under 24.6% in the IDC report, and that beats out number two Samsung at 16.5%. Also, Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that there's a greater chance that Apple may announce a new tablet very soon, the 10.5-inch bezel-less iPad Pro that we've been hearing about, the one that's going to replace the current 9.7-inch iPad Pro. He's thinking that Apple will make an announcement of that product at WWDC. It remains to be seen whether or not that's going to do enough to kind of stem the tide of iPad decline, but it should help at least in the short term to kind of slow things down for Apple and maybe even generate a little bit more revenue in the tablet space. And one other thing, tablet iPad related, if you've run into any functional issues recently with your iPad smart keyboard cover for your iPad Pro, Apple says they are going to take care of it. Apparently, some users have run into issues with faulty smart connectors, keys repeating or sticking, or keys just generally failing to respond on their smart keyboard covers. Apple says they're going to be covering those keyboard covers for up to 3 years for free. They'll be covering both the 9.7 and the 12.9-inch smart covers for any of these issues. They are going to be covered from within 3 years of their date of purchase, and the repairs must be made at the Apple Genius Bar by calling Apple Care Support or be done by an Apple authorized service provider to qualify. So if you've run into issues with your smart keyboard cover, you probably want to contact Apple either through Apple Care or getting into your Genius Bar, and they will definitely be repairing that for you. Strategy Analytics came out with their most recent estimated numbers on Apple Watch sales, and this is because Apple actually doesn't break them down in their quarterly results. They're just part of that whole other category. And they believe that Apple sold about 3.5 million Apple Watches in the last quarter, which is a massive number. That would actually be a 59% increase since last year, and it means that Apple would have captured 16% of the worldwide wearables market, beating out Fitbit for the first time. So this is a pretty big deal. That's a pretty big jump and a nice little crown for Apple to be able to wear. The report notes that there has been a general decline in demand for just fitness bands. So it seems like smartwatches are starting to gain more appeal among consumers, and Apple Watch seems to be on the top of that. And it's because of Apple's focus on performance enhancements and styling in the Apple Watch Series 2, along with some of their aggressive pricing strategies like the lower cost Apple Series 1, and better marketing that seems to really be paying off for Apple, or better or more marketing for the Apple Watch. And, you know, just as sort of, you know, non-scientific evidence, I have noticed just walking around, there are many, many more people with Apple Watches on their wrists. I am seeing them everywhere. Sometimes I think it's just because I'm an Apple fanboy and I just notice it, but more and more I'm trying to like push that out of my mind and just generally look at what people are wearing on their wrists, and I'm seeing fewer fitness bands and more Apple Watches. And that seems to go along with some of the things that this report is saying. So that's ultimately very good for Apple. And Apple is obviously focusing more on fitness and health. Another thing that happened this week related to Apple's fitness and health efforts is they quietly acquired a company called Bedit, which is one of the leading sleep tracker companies. And I had not heard of this company before, but they make a pretty unique product that is a sensor that goes between your bed sheets, or under your bed sheets rather, to track your movements while you sleep, your heart rate, your biometric data. And if you allow it to use the microphone on your iPhone, it will even detect when you're snoring. So it can kind of go through your sleep patterns. And as a matter of fact, Jeff Gamet on the iOS show said he absolutely loves the Bedit product. So Apple acquired the company. What was interesting is it wasn't really announced by Apple or even announced by Bedit. What happened was the news, quote unquote, was discovered by a privacy policy change that coincided with an update of their iOS app. And in it, they noted that they had been acquired by Apple and that the data collected would now be disclosed in accordance with Apple's privacy policy. So it was now, you know, the data is now covered by Apple's privacy policy because Apple owns the company. Now, it's unclear what Apple's going to do with the technology, if they're going to continue to sell the hardware product. It's a little bit unusual for Apple, although they do have things like Beats. So I don't know if they'll try and roll it into somehow into an updated future version of the Apple Watch and get rid of the external sensor, but I think that's a big part of the platform. It always could just be an acqui-hire sort of situation where they just wanted to get the engineers. Who really knows, but it's an interesting acquisition, and it does go along with some of their health efforts. Now, timing being a little bit weird on this next part, right after we heard about the acquisition of Bedit, which is a sleep tracking company, we also heard that Apple lost one of their top sleep experts. A report from Moby Health News said that Apple sleep scientist Roy J.E.M. Raymond has left the company. He had originally worked on technologies like Apple's night shift technology. That's the screen color shifting technology that's supposed to help put you into a better position to be able to go to sleep, getting rid of that blue light. And he also worked on the iOS bedtime alarm feature. So that's the reminder that reminds you to go to bed at the same time so that you're getting continuous and regular sleep. And apparently he also worked on several research kit and health kit initiatives as well. He actually left back in April, and he's actually now down here in San Diego working for Sleep Score Labs, which tries to help people who experience suboptimal sleep. So that's been going on as well. And then finally, on the health and Apple Watch front, a study by University of California, San Francisco says Apple Watch is 97% accurate at detecting a common abnormal heart rhythm condition. They worked on a study with the heart rate app Cardiogram, and they tracked about 6,158 participants using a deep neural network that was designed to identify abnormal heart rhythms from the Apple Watch's heart rate sensor data. And it turned out to be extremely accurate in this study, which is pretty interesting because the heart rate sensor, some people have been highly critical of it, although it seems to come up in scientific reports and in tests and things like that as being one of the more accurate versions of a heart rate sensor that you can get in a wearable. So this sort of seems to reaffirm that, and again, is just another feather in Apple's cap when it comes to the Apple Watch and health data. Huge news this week. If you are a fan of Amazon and Amazon Prime Video and you have an Apple TV, Recode reported this week that Amazon and Apple are close to finalizing a deal to bring an official Amazon Prime Video app to the Apple TV. This is something that those of us with Amazon Prime have been waiting for forever. It means we don't have to do the workaround anymore of doing AirPlay from the Amazon Prime Video app on our iPad or our iPhone. So this is really good news. And why is it happening now? Well, some other rumors are claiming that the deal actually started to come together at a, quote, high level, implying that maybe Tim Cook and Jeff Bezos actually just sat down together and kind of sorted things out. They just had a meeting and said, we need to get this done. Let's make this happen. And I've commented on that in the past, that saying that Apple really needed to go back to Amazon and figure out how to make this work. It generally is believed that a big sticking point was the terms that Apple has in terms of how you need to do in-app purchases. Amazon wants to sell in-app purchases for Amazon Prime subscriptions within the app, and Apple charges that 30% fee. Now, Apple's been waiving that fee or adjusting it for certain partners, and I'm sure they did that in the Amazon case. The question is going to be, how good a deal did they get? And I'm guessing it's going to be better than most. The rumor is that even for things like HBO, Apple has waived that fee down to 15%, and they actually have, I think, extended that to any video subscription app in a recent update. But I'm guessing Amazon got an even better deal. Now, when this actually will happen, it's believed it could arrive in the third quarter of this year, probably summer, maybe with a WWDC appearance, I thought, that seemed ripe for that, and BuzzFeed actually seems to agree. They say the app will be announced on stage at WWDC and that it will ship later this summer. They also say that the Apple TV will return to being sold on Amazon.com. That had actually been pulled again because Bezos said that they didn't want to confuse any Amazon customers that any set-top box was sold on Amazon did not support their Amazon Prime Video app. And since the Apple TV didn't support it, which this is a little like catch-22, because Amazon didn't make the app for the Apple TV, they weren't going to sell it on Amazon.com. So it had been pulled. It made kind of a big kerfuffle in the news. I'm sure we talked about it here on the MacCast back when it happened. But that is all over. It's seeming like they buried the hatchet. And, you know, Amazon and Apple, they've been at odds for years. Amazon actually pulled the Apple TV back in 2015, and they cited this unacceptable financial model and not wanting to cause this consumer confusion over the hardware sold on Amazon. Now, hopefully Amazon has reached what they consider to be acceptable terms, and we can stop, again, having to rely on AirPlay as sort of this workaround. So, good news if you want to do that. A little update on Apple's own video content offerings. Those seem to be chugging along, and it seems to be like they're moving in the direction of trying to get a lot of sort of music-related, concert-related, documentary-style videos. And one that a lot of people might be excited about is a Prince documentary. The Prince Estate is supposedly shopping around exclusive rights to an unreleased concert film that was recorded in Minneapolis about a year before Purple Rain was released. So kind of the Purple Rain era. And so supposedly features some of the songs that ended up in the Purple Rain movie and in the soundtrack. Now, reportedly, there might be enough extra footage to actually make a full documentary of the film. They've been talking to Apple. It's unclear whether or not they will actually be bringing that. And then on the audio radio front, it looks like Beats One may be getting a new show featuring Metallica's drummer Lars Ulrich, a show called It's Electric. It will supposedly be unscripted, quote unquote, and quote, all over the place. Now, what exactly that means, don't really know. Supposedly, they're going to be featuring a lot of music from all over the world, probably a lot of unknown bands that you haven't heard of. So if you are a Beats One fan or a fan of just general music discovery, this may be a new show worth checking out. But Apple continuing to plow forward with new Apple TV offerings and new stuff related to Apple Music that is somewhat interesting. Now, we can't let a week go by on the MacCast without some iPhone 8 rumors, right? We don't want to let that happen. Well, maybe we do. We're not going to do it this week, at least. There's some sketchy research note from Hong Kong-based equity research firm CLSA. They're saying there's, quote, a high chance that the Touch ID sensor on the rumored iPhone 8 will be on the back. Now, we've been going back and forth, no pun intended, on this for a while. Is the Touch ID sensor going to be on the back? Is it going to be on the front? This research note seems to kind of defy more recent leaks from what I consider to be some pretty reliable sources that Apple has sorted out how to get the Touch ID sensor on the front of the phone. So I don't think it's going to be happening. I think this is a general plan B, and Apple has abandoned it because they figured out how to get that Touch ID sensor on the front. So I'm not putting much stock in this, but just want to let you know that rumor is still floating around out there. JP Morgan analysts have mentioned something they're calling an enhanced receiver being in the iPhone 8. That was a rumor we hadn't heard of before. And the receiver, in case you don't know this, because I didn't realize this either, that's the little earpiece cutout that is above the screen. So think of a telephone receiver, you know, the part that you listen to on the telephone, you know, to hear the person who's talking to you. And that's the receiver part. So they're saying Apple is going to have a better enhanced version of that piece. And the speculation is that it would have at least a higher peak volume output, and that Apple could be trying to work in more water resistance, making the iPhone 8 even more water resistant than the current iPhone 7 and 7 Plus, which actually upped the game when it came to that. So that's pretty good. Now, that sounds fine, but then this rumor also, or the JP Morgan piece also mentions that the AirPods, Apple AirPods, would come as a free accessory along with your iPhone 8. And while that would be super awesome, I'd love to see that happen. Two things. First, Apple still can't seem to make AirPods fast enough. And we already know that the iPhone 8 is having these rumors of supply constraints. So this wouldn't help Apple's situation anymore. Now, granted, it's going to be happening in the fall, so that's a while from now. So maybe they could sort out the AirPod supply chain issues. But let me put it this way. They're not going to replace the cheapo Lightning EarPods that retail for $29 and probably cost Apple about 50 cents to make with a $149 set of wireless AirPods. It's just not going to happen. So don't even start to believe this rumor. There's just no way that's going to be reality. But the enhanced receiver, I'll buy into that. There are also rumors that the iPhone 8 will include a 3D camera module capable of facial recognition. We've talked about this a little bit, but now it's being said the module is actually being sourced and will be made by LG Innotek. They say the technology would include facial recognition, iris recognition, and 3D selfies, whatever that means, and use algorithms from PrimeSense, which was the company Apple acquired back in 2013. And how they will accomplish this is pretty interesting. One report says that Apple will add a second camera, a second FaceTime camera, probably with a 24 millimeter wide angle sort of lens or a 28 millimeter lens, and that the two together would be combined to enable this technology. We've also heard about the possibility of Apple including laser sensors that would, I guess, shoot lasers out and do some of the 3D recognition as well. So some pretty advanced technology going into this new iPhone. And as you're going to hear about a little bit later, that's going to be reflected in the price. Now, another thing we've been talking a lot about is this supply constraint problem and the fact that the iPhone 8 may be announced but may not ship till later than it normally does. Usually Apple ships it around September, October timeframe. We've been hearing October, November as being a potential shipping date. Now, Economic Daily News came out and said that Apple's actually getting a handle on their supply chain issues and that they may begin selling the iPhone in October following a September announcement. So alluding to the fact that there might not be any delay at all. And while this would be very welcome news, I'm being very cautious about it because they say that the production of the internal iPhone components is starting up in June. As a matter of fact, TSMC is reportedly going to be delivering volume quantities of the new A11 chips that are built using the 10 nanometer process in July. So that would be right on time. But while all this sounds great and positive, there are several other what I consider to be pretty reliable sources, including Ming-Chi Kuo, who has reiterated his belief that there will be quote-unquote severe supply shortages of the new iPhone 8, what I'm calling the iPhone Edition models. So I'm thinking it's going to be pretty bad, and I think it's still going to be pretty bad. I think Apple's going to hit the announcement date. I think we're going to hear about it in September, probably shipping in late October, early November in really, really limited quantities. You think the AirPods are hard to get a hold of? I'm saying the iPhone 8 is going to be even harder. Many of us are going to be lucky if we get one sometime in 2017. I think orders are going to be pushed out to 2018 very, very quickly on launch day. So get your fingers ready, your typing fingers ready, your Apple Store apps ready, because that's always, or for the last few launches, been the best way to actually get your hands on an iPhone, is to actually order through the app. And another bit of advice early, make sure you go in and set up Apple Pay and make sure it's working. I was thinking I might even try ordering just a small accessory in the morning just to make sure that there's no problems, because I had a situation one time where I went to use Apple Pay and I actually had an expired credit card and it wouldn't let me through, and I didn't notice that that had happened and it caused a delay and I ended up having to get a different model. This time around, that could be the difference between getting an iPhone in 2017 or having to wait till 2018. I think it's really going to be that bad, and I don't want to sort of understate that. Another thing that we saw this week that was a little bit of a weird rumor, there was, I think, a report coming out of China or Japan, or an image coming out of China, it was Weibo, of some rear shells that were glass. Now, we know that the iPhone 8 is going to supposedly be this all-glass sandwich, front glass, back glass, but these were reportedly for either an iPhone SE update or maybe the new iPhone 7S update, and made of strengthened Ion-X glass. Everything we've heard before this seems to indicate that the iPhone 7S would maintain the same design styling as the current iPhone 7 and 7 Plus, with the metal back and same design. So this report seems a little bit sketchy, but I wanted to mention it because it was floating around out there. Now, again, speculation on pricing on the iPhone 8. Goldman Sachs analyst came out this week and said he expects the 128-gigabyte model to sell for US $999 and the 256-gigabyte version to sell for US $1099. So over $1,000 for iPhone 8. And that seems to be in line with earlier rumors we heard that it would be above $1,000 for this iPhone. And I expect that to happen because of all of the components we've been hearing going in here. The camera system, which is 3D on the front and 3D on the back, facial recognition, new processors, wireless charging. There is a lot of new stuff going into this phone, and that translates into a lot of new component parts and a lot more expensive parts going in there. And Apple is not one to just eat those sorts of costs. They like their high average selling prices, and they're going to get the money back out of it. So if you're planning on buying an iPhone 8, just be prepared for a little bit of sticker shock. You're going to be paying quite a bit of money, especially if you want to buy them outright. Now, the reality is most people go on the monthly plan, the upgrade every year plan, and so it's a little less of a hit. I'm a, as you know, out-of-pocket guy, so I'm going to be saving my pennies up until this launch, and hopefully I'll be able to get one this year. If you are on a budget, one other little iPhone story that may be of interest to you: Apple has brought their budget iPhone to the US. Apple actually has a 32 gigabyte space gray version of the couple year old iPhone 6, not the 6S, the actual 6 model. They've been selling it in price sensitive regions like India, China, and Taiwan. You can now get that in the US on Virgin Mobile. They're offering it at $199 with no contract. So pretty low cost on that iPhone. Again, it's a couple years old, so you kind of Got to take that along with it. AT&T apparently also offers it, but they're selling it for $345. So your probably best deal is to pick it up on Virgin Mobile get it for $199 if that's the deal that you're looking for. But that's kind of the latest in iPhone news this week. Do you know about Apple's street mapping team? Yeah, Apple has these vans driving around all over the U.S. and actually a couple of countries overseas, France, Italy, and England. They are collecting mapping data, and they've been spotted for the first time in Connecticut. So that means we now know these things are cruising around in 34 states. Apple also seems to be sending the vans out into new areas in Arizona, in New York. You may have seen these driving around. I think they actually have Apple branding on them. Apple is definitely not trying to hide them. They actually have a website you can go to. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com that lists the details on where the vehicles are going to be operating and when. So you can kind of see if they're driving around in your town next week. You can check the website. As far as what they're doing, they're laden with a bunch of sensors. They are there, Apple says, to improve Apple Maps. And Apple does not offer a street view kind of version in Apple Maps, but they are collecting photos and data. As a matter of fact, on the website, Apple says, quote, "We blur faces and license plates on collected images prior to publication." As far as I know, Apple's not publishing these images or showing them anywhere. So it's curious if that's some sort of indication that maybe Apple will be adding a street maps style feature to Apple Maps sometime in the future. I would love to see that. I think that's a really handy feature of Google Maps and something that's been severely missing from Apple Maps. So I would love that to be going on. Now, another thing that a lot of people think Apple might be using this data for is their autonomous vehicle project. And I think that goes hand in hand with the Apple Maps project. I think the two really go together. So I think that makes a lot of sense. But if you've seen these things driving around and seen and wondered what they are, yep, Apple actually has them. And you can kind of track them again on that Apple website. Another thing that Apple has been doing since about 2015 is revamping and refreshing the look of the Apple stores. They've gone to this whole new look with more wood, more stone, natural materials. And they announced the look back in 2015, starting with the Belgium store in Brussels and then also the San Francisco Union Square store. So if you've been to either of those, you know Apple has this kind of more open layout. They have fronts on the stores that now completely open up to the environment. The Genius Bar has become the Genius Grove. They've got trees. They've got that Johnny Ive designed wall-sized video display, motion-activated power sockets on the tables, which is really cool. So when you go into the tables, you can kind of wave your hand over the back of it and the power ports will pop up. And it's great for all of the new stores that Apple's building because they can kind of design this stuff in. But you know Apple has hundreds and hundreds of older stores. So what about all those? And what about maybe some of the stores that don't have the space for like the giant big screen TV? Well, now we're hearing rumors that Apple is planning for some of their older stores and smaller stores a kind of overnight refresh to happen on May 16th, and they're going to try and better match the new look of the granite and the wood, bringing in new materials. I can't imagine that they're going to be swapping out, you know, the entire floors or anything like that, but they could put in new displays and those sorts of things. Probably bring in more foliage, more plants, I'm guessing, and rearrange the layout to kind of give them that town square feel that Angela Ahrens has talked about. They're trying to make the Apple Store as a place where people want to go and just hang out with each other. And I think they've been pretty successful at doing that, especially if you've been, again, to like the San Francisco store. There's a lot of people that just hang out there, or the New York stores and things like that. So they're trying to bring in that feel of the other locations to some of the older stores. And what I'm hoping is that they really get those new cool display walls for the accessories, where they kind of have the pull-out drawers. Apple calls that section, I think, now the Avenue. So you can walk down the Avenue of Accessories. They've got these sort of demo areas and little insets that they put in. And supposedly they're going to be doing that to a lot of the older stores too. And it's kind of a cool new look. They have these little, great little stands that they have the headphones on that you can try them out. And it's pretty neat if you haven't seen it. So your little local Apple store may be getting refreshed to kind of bring in some of these elements. And it should be pretty neat to see. So I'm hoping the ones around me get refreshed. And if they do, I'll go in and take a look and talk about it, maybe post some pictures on social media and things like that. And if you want to do that in your area too, after the 16th, let's kind of track this and see what's going on with Apple retail. And then finally, in the news for this week, if you saw the little Tim Cook Mad Money Jim Cramer appearance, he announced that Apple was setting up this new advanced manufacturing fund and that they would be announcing who the first recipient of the fund was later this month. Well, later this month has come and Apple has announced that Corning, the makers of Gorilla Glass, the glass that's used in the iPhone and Apple Watch and a bunch of Apple products, they're going to be receiving the first money out of this $1 billion fund. They're going to get $200 million of it, and it's to support Corning's research and development, their capital equipment needs, and their state-of-the-art glass processing. The Apple press release says that their existing relationship with Apple has helped Corning create nearly 1,000 American jobs, and they're trying to get more jobs created by giving them this investment. And you know, now, at first, to me, when I heard that it was Corning, it seemed like an odd choice because Apple already has an existing relationship with Corning. Corning's been highly successful selling their glass to not only Apple, but Samsung and tons of companies. So it didn't seem like, you know, this was a company that really needs a $200 million cash infusion investment from somebody. But then I had to remember back to some of the comments Tim Cook made during the Mad Money piece about what this fund is for. The idea behind this fund is that Apple wants to invest in advanced American manufacturing companies. So established companies that are already doing manufacturing in the U.S., give them money to expand and do more things in the hopes of creating more U.S. manufacturing jobs, not just within those companies. Cook commented that they're looking to create this ripple in the pond effect around U.S. manufacturing jobs, with the jobs that Apple creates from this fund spawning other manufacturing jobs around those jobs and so on. So by investing in an advanced manufacturing company like Corning, Corning also has suppliers that are in the manufacturing area, and they're going to need more supplies from those. So that demand increases, meaning there's this kind of trickle-down effect that goes on. So that's kind of the idea behind this, starting with more advanced companies and creating jobs that then create other jobs that create other jobs and so on down the line. And larger companies, you know, as they grow, they're going to create more opportunities at their facilities and more opportunities for their suppliers as well. So that's the whole idea behind it. And it made a little more sense when I started thinking about it in that context. But that's what's going on with Apple's Advanced Manufacturing Fund. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. So something we've been talking about for a couple episodes now is this weird situation that happened, starting with a question out of Indianapolis. A listener had gone to a sporting event there and was taking photos and noticed that the Wi-Fi location or the location on those photos was off. There was they were actually showing the location of the visiting team's stadium. And we've been going back and forth on why that, you know, why that may or may not be happening. I think the general conclusion that most people have come to is that the sports teams travel around with their own equipment, or they set up their own VPNs, they have their own Wi-Fi, and that maybe it was picking up that Wi-Fi location as the actual location. And simply doing a reset of the iPhone or disconnecting from Wi-Fi and turning Wi-Fi back on seems to resolve those kinds of problems so that you connect to a local Wi-Fi network. And Wi-Fi location in general, it gets really weird. And so I've been getting more comments and stories from you, comments like this one from Eric.
Hi, Adam. This is Eric from Menlo Park. I just wanted to relate a story that my folks have about two-factor authentication and the location that they get on their prompt for authenticating the login. My folks live in San Luis Obispo, California, a town you probably know where it is. And my folks, when they try to log on, they get a notice saying there's a person trying to log in from Medford, Oregon. And this threw them for a loop for quite some time. They never quite correlated in time the fact that they were getting this message after they themselves were attempting to do a login. They never figured that out. But when I was visiting them one time, I noticed this problem going on and said, hey, you know, you just tried to log on, you know, so stop that, try to log on again. And again, the message would pop up again from Medford, Oregon. So no new data here. You've already seen this problem before, but just another example. And it was quite confusing for them for quite some time. So I think this location stuff being off is an issue. And it's funny that it was so far away. But anyway, love the show. Keep it up. Been listening for, I think, years and years and years. So thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Hey, you're welcome, Eric. And thanks for sending in that comment. Yeah, I actually very well know San Luis Obispo. I went to school there. And actually, my family heads up there every year, as you probably know, for a camping trip at Pismo Beach, one of the highlights of our year. So definitely familiar with that area, and definitely that is nowhere near Medford, Oregon, which is odd, right? Or it seems odd at first. And I actually need to make a correction to my comments about how Wi-Fi location works, because I believe on past episodes I kept saying that it uses the IP address, that there's companies like Skyhook that maintain these databases so that when a device doesn't have GPS or can't access GPS, and when your iPhone can't use cell tower triangulation to figure out your location, it falls back onto the Wi-Fi network. And I had been saying that it used IP address, and I know that's not correct. What it actually uses is the media access control address, the MAC address of your device, and that's what's registered in this database. So IP addresses actually change pretty frequently, but the MAC address of your device is not going to change, or your router, whatever that might be. And so Wi-Fi, I think your IP address is actually, I believe, used for geolocation-based, like browser-based location. So when your browser asks for your location, I think it uses that. But for iOS devices and routers and hardware devices, it actually uses the MAC address. And that's the unique identifier that gets assigned to the network interface for communications. And so it actually uses more than that. It uses a combination of the SSID for your wireless network and the MAC address registration in these databases. And that's the thing that can get off. So in thinking about your parents' situation, Eric, what I was wondering, and maybe you can give us a little bit of follow-up, is if they purchased their modem or Wi-Fi router used, or maybe it was provided to them or given to them by a family member, or maybe it was even one that was provided by their cable or satellite company, and if it's possible that maybe that device lived at some point in Medford, Oregon. So that's typically how this thing happens, is somehow the MAC address for their router, their thing that they used to connect to the internet, was at some point in Medford, Oregon. That got registered in this database, and then that's why the location is off. And that's why things like the sports team, you know, moving, if they bring their own equipment from their home stadium and then bring it to the visiting stadium, that MAC address is going to be associated in this Wi-Fi database as being at the home stadium location. And that's why these things get off. So that's probably what's going on here. The mystery is going to be, how did that router, or why does that router think it was or ever lived in Medford, Oregon? And it could just be that somebody registered it incorrectly, right? It just random happenstance that somebody put in the MAC address into the database, and it happened to be the MAC address for your parents' router, and it wasn't the one for the one that actually lives in Medford, Oregon. You know, these things are sort of imprecise, and they're maintained by people. You can actually even go to some of these websites. Like, I know Skyhook's website will let you register your device. And people have even commented to me since we started talking about this that, yeah, hey, I moved, and when I did Wi-Fi location on my Mac, it was still reporting, or my Apple TV, it was still reporting my old address. So I went in actually into the company's database, into the Skyhook database, and changed it. But there's three or four companies that actually do this now. So I'm not sure that just changing it one would work for all of them. But certainly, you know, the weirdness of Wi-Fi location or the inaccuracy of Wi-Fi location could cause people some sort of heartache and headaches, as you pointed out in your story. And I love the fact that you told your parents great advice, which was, hey, try just logging out and try logging back in again and see if it does it again. And then you'll know from timing that, yeah, that's actually you trying to use the device. And I've had a few other MacCast listeners comment on that too, saying that I thought this was weird at first, but then I realized, oh, this is actually me trying to log in and it's all okay. So recognizing that is good too, because it's scary at first to think, who's trying to hack into my account? But thanks for sharing your story, Eric. Let's talk about slaying lightning bunnies. I know I don't like cruelty to animals, but we're talking about the little dust bunnies that can work their way into your lightning connector. And if you hadn't heard the last episode of the MacCast, you might not know what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is your lightning connector is open, and some people have reported that, you know, I think my cable is worn out because I'm trying to plug in, and if I wiggle the cable just a little bit or bump the cable a little bit, it disconnects and then it reconnects and it disconnects and reconnects. And what many of us have realized is that what has happened is through the process of just putting our iPhones in our pocket, lint has worked its way into the lightning connector. And if you get enough smashed down at the bottom, like a little sort of shim, it can prevent your lightning connector from actually seating all the way and making actually a good connection. So I mentioned, if you run into this problem, you might want to just clean out your lightning connector. And I was trying to ask the best way to do this. I mentioned that I've done it with a wooden toothpick, and that I didn't think that was actually probably the best thing that you should be jamming in your lightning connector, especially because the little wooden tip could break off. And if that gets stuck in there, that could be even worse than the lightning bunny that could be in there. So a lot of you wrote in and said that I recommend a toothpick, but not a wooden one. Use a plastic toothpick. You know, find one of those. Or many, many people recommended the little plastic dental flossers that you can get that have the picks on the end. And one of the ones that I thought might be the best that someone recommended was the little rubber-tipped gum, the brand gum. They make something called a soft pick, and it has a little rubber tip that kind of has little bristles on it, almost looks like a little pointy brush, and that works great for sort of picking it out. And it's probably not going to cause problems with the connector because it's nice and soft on your iPhone, so you don't have to worry about damaging that. And another recommendation from a lot of people was the toothpick that's built into a Swiss Army knife, the little plastic one that's built in there. And a lot of people don't know you can actually buy replacements for those. So if you just want to buy a dedicated tool, you can maybe go on Amazon.com and buy one of those. But I think that my favorite was certainly the gum soft picks. So you might want to try that. Now, in addition to all those recommendations, I received a lot of images of slain bunnies. And all I can say is there's some disgusting lightning ports out there in our community. I'm not judging, because mine's pretty gross too, so I'm in that group, but yeah, it's pretty nasty. No judgment, just an observation, and a recommendation that you may want to clean your lightning connector out from time to time. So, just some general advice for you. All right, that's what we try and do here. Help people out here on the MacCast. So with all these rumors going around that Apple may be bringing Siri into our living rooms with this sort of home device, I'm getting a lot of questions and some concerns from our community. And I want to talk about those a little bit, because the most vocal are those of you out there for whom Siri seems to not just work. The people who say, my experience with Siri is horrible. Siri never works, doesn't do the right thing, she can't understand me. I hear that a lot from a lot of people. And unfortunately, all I can say is that my experience with Siri has been generally positive. But I know that she can cause nothing but frustration for people. Just ask Ewan Rankin over at the Mac show at British Tech Network. If you've heard me talking on that show, Ewan hates Siri. Siri never works for him. He's a big Alexa fan. And that's fine. But all I want to do is point out that no digital assistant is perfect. As a matter of fact, I've tried Alexa. I don't get it. It's fine. It works fine for me. It's not that it doesn't work. It's just that I don't see much of a difference between Alexa or Siri, in my opinion. Siri does just fine for me. The one big difference is that Alexa doesn't have a screen to fall back on. So, and we've talked about this on the Maccast. So she tends to give full answers in text when she can. But I get just as many, I can't find an answer for that with Alexa as I do Siri. So I don't see that as a problem. And that's really not what I want to talk about. Digital assistants are okay. They're going to get better. They're going to get smarter over time. Ben wrote in to ask me what I think are some very poignant questions about this issue and the kinds of things that I do think are worth discussing. I don't want to get into a debate about which digital assistant is the best digital assistant, because some work for people, some don't, and everybody has their own experiences. But what Ben asked me about was a couple things. He did say that he was in the camp of Siri just doesn't understand me. And again, not to be dismissive, I want to move beyond that problem because I don't think it's unique. Ben did mention that he uses Google's assistant, the Google Now thing, and it works for him first time every time. So he was kind of a fan of Google. And so maybe, Ben, you know, Google Home is the right product for you. I think, digital assistants are digital assistants. But what I will say for all digital assistants is I am of the mind that they need to get smarter about interpreting words in terms of context and intent, not just processing the words. I think they're getting very good at processing the words and understanding what we're saying. And for specific commands and specific things that they've been trained for, they can give us responses. But the minute you deviate from that, the minute you move outside of that, that's where things get weird. You know, stuff starts to happen, like when you're asking for directions and it should be looking for maps and locations, and suddenly it's giving you movie times. And why is that happening? It's because you didn't ask in the right way or in the right context. You tried to just be a human being and the machine couldn't figure out what was going on. And I've also had the situation where it's likely, you know, where I just wish it would understand I'm likely looking for something local and not thousands of miles away. So in this example, I might be asking for a certain business and suddenly it's giving me a business that's across the country in New England or something like that. And it's like, no, I mean, obviously I'm here in San Diego. I'm probably going to want something within a certain mileage range. I'm not going to be asking for some weird, far off, far away thing. Now, again, at some point later, though, I might be asking for that. And if I am, the assistant needs to be smarter about interpreting that. So that's what I'm talking about, the intent or the context. Time of day is another sort of thing that I think it could be smarter about. You know, I'm probably not looking for a bar, or hopefully not looking for a bar at 7 a.m. I'm probably looking for a coffee shop or a place to have breakfast. So why would you give me a bar response when I'm asking for a place to eat and it's 7 a.m. in the morning? Like, can we just be a little bit smarter and a little bit more human about how we're interpreting things? And again, I've commented on this many times. Siri's dependence on a screen or the web, that needs to change. Yeah, Phil Schiller made recent comments saying that in some cases you want a screen, but I'm still hoping it changes because, again, a lot of people call Alexa smarter, and I think they call her smarter because she answers your response every time with her voice. And, you know, dumping to the web saying, I don't know, you know, here's an answer on the web, that feels like I could have just Googled that myself. Like, why do I need you, Siri? That's just stupid. I asked you the question. You're not going to give me the answer. Tell me to go look it up. You know, it's like that. I don't know. Why don't you go look it up answer? And nobody really likes that answer, right? You don't want that answer when you're asking a question, because obviously you're asking it for a reason. So, and another thing I think about digital assistants that needs to get better is it's not just getting an answer, right? You want more. The assistant needs to be able to figure out the intent of the query, retrieve and respond back with enough information to be correct, but not with everything, right? You don't want this verbal answer just spewing out the entire contents of a Wikipedia article. You want it to be able to parse and realize what you're looking for and put that down into something coherent, something relevant, and something that, you know, you can use. And the assistant needs to sort of vet the information, right? You want it to be able to do that. But how do you do that? You know, that's the challenge. What about biases? You know, if you're asking for political information, do you want biases coming into that? Do you want biases on your news information? How do you get around that? How do you get around the digital assistant doing that? And those are the kinds of things that get, I think, difficult and tricky really fast. Those are going to be the things that are going to be really hard to figure out. And that is where I think the sort of winner in all of this is going to be determined, right? In figuring out intent and figuring out how to get the right information every time, relevant information, all those sorts of things. And that's where these assistants are sort of falling short at this point. And that's where a lot of this artificial intelligence technology is going to come into play. And yeah, it seems like Apple isn't moving in this space. They're not moving quickly, as quickly as some other companies. But I think also some of those other companies are playing fast and loose with our information, with our privacy. A big thing that happened this week that I'm a little bit miffed about is Amazon, with their Alexa system, added this voice calling technology. So you can actually voice call from one Amazon Alexa device to another Alexa device. But to do this, you do it through the Alexa app. And I think you can also call someone who has the Alexa app on their iPhone or their Android phone. To do it, Amazon wants you to upload your entire contacts database to Amazon's servers. So basically, give Amazon everybody in your address book. And they ask, you know, you have to give permission to do that. But I think a lot of people don't realize sort of the kinds of information they're giving up. And not only that, I read another piece saying that you have no way, once you've done that, there's no way to block individual callers. So if you're using this voice calling on Alexa and someone else is, and they have you in their contacts database, they can call you regardless. And, you know, I don't know about you, but in my contacts, I have all kinds of people in there that are, you know, people that I wouldn't want calling me on my Alexa just out of the blue. I have them in there for a reason. They're people that I do need to talk to from time to time, you know, old employees or old coworkers that I worked with. I have contacts in the media stuff, you know, business contacts for the Maccast, PR people, all that sort of stuff. I have their contact information in there, and I probably don't want them reaching out to me on my Alexa. If they want to call my phone, if they want to send me an email, that's fine. So, you know, privacy, I think, is a big thing. And a lot of people say, you know, Siri is limited by Apple's stance on privacy. And while it's a hurdle, I don't think it's a really big roadblock. I think Apple has proven that they can do incredible artificial intelligence calculations locally on the device. I mean, just look at what they built into the Photos app with image recognition and facial recognition and all those sorts of things. I think where Apple has fallen short on that part of the thing is, again, in sort of context, in using the local information that it actually has available to it and using artificial intelligence on top of that to figure out intent of queries and the kinds of information that I'm looking for. So things like my contacts, Apple's able to do a lot with contacts, and they don't have to upload it like Amazon is doing to their servers. They don't need you to give up that information. Location data, stuff that's in my schedule, the stuff that's in my to-dos, my apps, my documents, my mail, all of those things say a lot about who I am, what I do, the kinds of tasks that I might be asking for. Siri knows my tastes in music and movies and books. So if I'm asking about movies, she can probably be pretty certain that I'm asking about some sort of sci-fi movie or action adventure movie, that I'm not going to be asking about musicals because I don't watch those. I don't like those. So those are the kinds of intents and things that can be built into an artificial intelligence system to make these assistants work better. Siri knows what I buy. If I'm using Apple Pay, she has all that information, and a lot of that stuff's local. She has all the stuff that's in my emails that she has access to and can parse and index and do those things. How much I exercise or I don't exercise, when I go out, where I go, how often I go to certain places, when I'm at home, when I'm not at home. All of these habits, yes, they'll deviate from time to time, but most of us are creatures of habit, right? And Apple has access to all this data. So while it sounds creepy, they need to access and use this information. It's exactly what a real-world assistant would do and operate with. If you have an assistant, the whole point is they know you. They can anticipate your needs. They can respond appropriately. And I think at this point, this is where a lot of the digital assistants are falling short. And I don't think it's their fault. I don't think it's like engineers being stupid or not knowing how to do this. I think this is just technology that is developing. It's cutting edge. It's bleeding edge. It's getting better and better every day by leaps and bounds. And it's going to be absolutely amazing. The last thing that I think Apple needs to think about in bringing out a home assistant is the challenges of a multi-user environment like the living room. And this is an area where everything else that's out on the market currently really falls short. They don't support multiple levels of users, multiple user accounts. And when you start talking about knowing the person and all the other things that I've talked about in terms of being able to determine context and stuff like that, this is going to be really relevant, right, in a multi-user environment in a home. My kids are going to ask about different things than my wife or I might ask about. And our preferences are going to be different. And all the things that go around making who we are and the kinds of things we might be asking an assistant for, those need to change depending upon who's asking the question. And how do you do that? You know, how do you build in those smarts? What about parental controls? There's going to be certain things that I don't want my kids to have access to, and I want the digital assistant to know about that. What about using voice and geolocation, knowing who's home, who might be asking commands, right? They can use other data from our devices to be smarter and more intelligent about how they're working with us. So, you know, Apple may be, quote unquote, late to this party, but I think there's a big reason for it. And I think a lot of it is a lot of the things that I've been talking about. A lot of people have been complaining that they're not advancing Siri fast enough. I think they've been working on some amazing stuff. Look at all of the acquisitions they've been doing and all of the research they've been doing and the kinds of people they've been hiring. And I think you can get a pretty good idea about what Apple's thinking about. And I think they want to make sure that they get this right, that it makes sense, and they don't rush to market with something that isn't thought out. So I'm very excited to see what we might hear about at WWDC in terms of this assistant. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get a lot of information because I don't think they're going to have a product. I guess we're hearing they're going to have a product totally ready to go. So if they demo a product for us, we're going to see some amazing things. If it's more they talk to developers about the APIs, which is generally what they do at WWDC, then we may have to wait a little bit longer to get, you know, the full details about what we're going to see here. But I think Siri is going to become an amazing digital assistant, personal assistant with a lot of artificial intelligence behind her and what's important to me, a big focus on security, maintaining security and privacy of our data. And I think that will leapfrog Siri and put her leaps and bounds ahead of the competition. So even though it feels like Apple's behind in this race now, Apple has often been thought of as being behind in races, say with things like smartphones or MP3 players or other kinds of technologies. and they tend to come out on top in the long run. And a lot of the early runners, the things that people thought were out ahead, they tend to fall away. Fitbit might be another example of that, right? So I don't know. That's something I've been thinking about since this story broke, and I wanted to share with you. And what do you think? You know, share your thoughts and opinions. As always, shoot me an email, audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. A big part of what I try to do here on the MacCast, of course, is give advice, tips and tricks, answer your questions. That's what it's all about, right? Reaching out to the community. And Corey wrote in this week, and he was having trouble tracking down an answer to a question, so he emailed me for help, and that's what I want you guys to do, and I was able to hopefully help him. I haven't heard back from him yet, but I tried to answer his question the best I could. But he also mentioned, as many of you do when you email me, that, hey, I looked online, I tried to find the answer to this, and I appreciate that. Believe me, I appreciate you trying to do some research on your own and using, you know, the MacCast as sort of your last resort, because a lot of this information is out there. But he said, you know, I did some Googling, I couldn't find my answer, but I'm wondering, you know, could you maybe share some tips and tricks on specifically for finding answers to Mac and Apple technology questions? You know, what can I do? How can I do smarter searching? What are some tips and tricks? And I thought that was a great question because we don't talk about this too much. You know, a lot of people will say, go search Google. But there's lots of ways to search Google, and Google might not always be the place that you need to be searching, right? It's a great resource. It's awesome. I can't imagine our life with the internet without it at this point, but it's not always the best thing. And especially when you're looking for Mac technical help, I think there's some other places that I typically start before I end up on Google. So, you know, get a little more direct, I think, is my first bit of advice. This one's a little self-serving, but also very, very useful. The MacCast forum. I'm telling you guys, I mention this at the end of every show, and if you don't listen all the way to the end, maybe you haven't heard this, but, you know, we have a forum, and there are some great MacCast community members on there. John, I'm going to forget a bunch of people. John Foster, though, answers a lot of technical questions on there. Graham used to be on there a while back. I'm not sure if he's there anymore. I try and get in there from time to time now. I'm trying to do it more frequently. But go to forum.maccast.com, sign up for a free account, and you can get direct help from the MacCast community. And usually within hours, at least within a day or two, you're going to get an answer to your question. So use that as a resource. It's there and available to you. But, you know, Apple's discussion board, I think a lot of people forget about that, or just their support website. Apple has done a great job of really improving their support website. I really like the new layout. I like the new flow of things. They kind of almost have this wizard that walks you through, you know, what are you having a problem with? What's going on? And they bring back both Apple tech support answers as well as community answers. You know, so they'll drill you into their discussion board if that's what, you know, if that's where the answer might be. But you can go to discussions.apple.com or apple.com/support. I would start there because more direct, if you're looking for an Apple-related answer, it's going to be there. And even when you do it in Google, that's generally the place that you're going to end up at. So why not just go direct to the source? Another great resource, Ask Different, the Apple Stack Exchange, apple.stackexchange.com. Stack Exchange, a lot of developers know about Stack Exchange because for coding questions, they have all these, I don't know if you call them channels or just exchanges, whatever it might be, but specifically devoted to different kinds of programming. So there's, you know, a PHP one and a Python one and a JavaScript one. There's also ones for like WordPress and different blogging platforms and stuff like that. It is a great resource. A lot of really good technical smart people are over there. So use Ask Different. It's a great, great resource. So go a little more direct. That's kind of my first tip. Then some general searching tips that people may or may not know. If you want to do a search on multiple words that are together, like a specific phrase, wrap it in double quotes. So, for example, if you were searching for... I don't know, iPhone case. If you just type iPhone case and do a search, it's going to search for iPhone or case, and you're probably going to get a lot more results than you wanted. Put that in double quotes, and most search systems are going to search for just that, those two words together. They're going to search for iPhone case, and you're going to get a lot more relevant results. So that's one tip. Try using what are called Boolean words, or, you know, connecting words, if you want certain words to go together or be one word or the other. So you can use the word and. So Apple and AirPods, or chicken or fish, right? So put in those Boolean words, and those can sometimes help. I've also started to find that most search systems are getting pretty smart. And if you do what I call natural language searches, this is great in the Finder, actually on the Mac, especially under Mac OS Sierra. Just ask a question, type it out just in the same way you might ask a person with your voice. Write the exact long phrase. It seems a little bit weird at first, but you'll probably find that you get more accurate and more relevant results when you do that. So just ask it in a normal way. So those are some general searching tips. Now, some Google-specific things that people don't know about. Now, I'm going to give you my number one tip for Google. And this changed my life. I've shared this with a lot of people, and they've said it's changed their life as well. So go do a Google search. You can even, you know, stop the podcast and do it right now if you want. Do a normal Google search on google.com, and then up at the top, kind of over to the right, if you're on an iOS device, it might be in a different spot, but look along the area just under the search bar at the top. When, you know, you've got the search results under that, but between the search results and the search box, there's going to be a little bar, a menu bar. Look on there for something called tools. Tap on that. And how many times have you been doing a Google search and it starts returning results from like 5 years ago? And when you're looking for a technical, especially a computer question, a technical question, what are the odds that you want the answer that someone gave in 2009? In 2017, probably slim to none. So under tools, what you can do is there's a time frame. You'll see a drop down menu called anytime. Click on that and you'll get a drop down menu, and you can select all kinds of time ranges, including a custom range. The two I use most frequently, past year, past month. And that means it will re-perform that same Google search, but only show you results that are relevant for the past year or past month. It is amazing, amazing how much more relevant results you will get if you start using that. They also, if you're using Google Image Search, they have a ton of image filters. You can search by color. You can search by image size. You can search by image type. There are a lot of options under there. Use that tools menu. Use it a lot, and you will fall in love with it. I do not do a Google search anymore, I don't think, without using that menu. So there's that. A lot of people don't know you can put a plus symbol or a minus symbol between the words in your Google search, and that means either include this word or exclude this word. Plus to include a word, minus to exclude a word. So if you do a Google search and you're getting a bunch of results that have some common word in it that aren't the relevant results, just add minus plus that word to your Google search, and it will filter it down more. Another thing you can do is you can use an asterisk as a wild card. So if you want to do a more general search, you can do that. And another really handy one is if you want to Google search a specific website. A lot of people don't know, if you start the search, site, S-I-T-E, colon, and then the website domain, so site, colon, apple.com, and then space, and then do your Google search, Google will only show you search results for that term from apple.com and no other website. Or you could do site, and I do this one a lot, site:discussions.apple.com. And then I will only get search results from Apple's discussion boards. And that is really, really handy. So those things can all help you out when you're searching for help on Google or directly on some other websites. So, Corey, hopefully that helps you out. And thanks for asking that question, because I think it's something that we forget that, you know, not everybody knows all these little tips and tricks for kind of doing searching. And by the way, in case you're wondering, what was Corey's issue that he originally emailed me about? He was actually mentioning that he was using Microsoft Office, specifically Word, on iOS. And as he was typing, the cursor went under and behind the QuickType keyboard suggestions, you know, the little thing at the top of your iPad keyboard. And he had to keep scrolling up so that he could actually see the text that he was typing, and it was really slowing him down and causing a problem. So he wanted to find a way to either fix that or work around it. And I tried this out as I was prepping the show. It seems to be fixed in the latest version of Word for iOS. Now when you go behind that, it scrolls itself up. So I'm guessing that Microsoft knew it was an issue and they worked around it. So it seems to be fixed for now. But I want to mention what I mentioned to Corey, which was a lot of people don't know you can actually turn off the QuickType area. So if you tap and hold on the globe or the emoji icon, the keyboard switching icon on the virtual keyboard, hold it down for a second, you're going to get a pop-up menu, and then you can slide up or tap on the predictive option. There's a toggle that says predictive, and that will allow you to toggle on or off that predictive QuickType keyboard. So you can just simply shut it off. You'll probably also notice when you're in this menu that you can also turn off the shortcuts. So if you use the keyboard shortcuts in the keyboard settings, you can turn those on or off too. Occasionally, you may not want those corrections to be happening. So nice little toggle there. So that's how you do it. You can just simply turn off the QuickType area if that's getting in your way. Just remember that if you want to turn it back on, you do the same thing. So there you go. And thank you, Corey, for your input and your question.
Since you introduced Black Box to us through your podcast, Thing of the Moments, I'm going bonkers, and it's all your fault.
If introducing Black Box to you through Thing of the Moment has driven you bonkers, then I'm happy to have done it, because it's an awesome app. And I have another awesome app for you today on the Thing of the Moment, something I'm super excited about. It is a new game from the makers of the Carrot apps. Yes, it's called Artificial Super Intelligence. You know, I love Carrot. I'm a big fan of Carrot apps, Carrot Weather, Carrot Health for calorie tracking. I'm trying to remember the actual names. I just call them the Carrot apps. I have one for health. I have one for tracking my weight. I wish I could get the names right. I'm probably mutilating the names. Sorry to the makers of Carrot for doing that. Just the Carrot apps. Go to meetcarrot.com and you can check out all their great applications. But now they have their first game app, and it is fun. Guys, you should check it out. The concept is it's another swipe left, right story kind of game. Another thing of the moment I think I had a while back was a game called Reigns, where you play a king and you're sort of running a kingdom and you swipe left or right to make different decisions. This is very similar. It's called Artificial Super Intelligence, and you are a startup founder and you are trying to create an artificial super intelligence called Carrot, the world's first sentient supercomputer. And in each round, you start in a different parallel universe or parallel world. And kind of the rules of each world impact, you know, how the gameplay is going to go and the kinds of decisions that you need to make. But basically what you're trying to do is answer different questions, make different decisions as people come up to you in the game. And it's, you know, text-based with some great humor, of course, a lot of wit and a lot of sarcasm. and pop culture references thrown in and stuff like that. And you have to make these different decisions, and you pull to the left and you get one answer, and you pull to the right and you get the other answer or a different answer, and you have to pick which one is correct. And correct means the one that is going to keep your kind of world in balance. You're trying to keep four different groups of people happy and in balance. You don't want any one group getting too happy, but you don't want any one group getting too upset. And the four different groups are your programmers who are working to build your sentient supercomputer, the investors who are paying for it, the government who's trying to regulate everything, and then the general public, bloggers, media, hipsters, the people that you're trying to sell your product to or market your product to. You need to keep all of these groups happy, and the longer you can do that, the better you're going to do it in the game, and the more intelligent, the better carrot your sentient supercomputer is going to get. And in each world, you're progressing toward one of 52 different endings. So you have different endings, and then you move on to the next world and you kind of continue the game. So it's kind of this ongoing, never ending game. Well, I'm saying never ending. I haven't reached the end of it yet, but I've only been playing for like a day, to be honest. But it is super fun. And each world, again, kind of shapes how your answers and decisions are going to be thrown at you. It is a ton of fun. It's a nice little casual game. You can play it for a little while and put it away. Very reasonably priced. It's priced right now, introductory priced, at $2.99 US. It's normally going to be $3.99 US. No in-app purchase, none of that annoying stuff. Just a lot of fun and humor. And, of course, Carrot. So it is great, and you should check it out. Even if it is going to drive you bonkers. I don't think this one's going to drive you bonkers. I think you're just going to enjoy it and have a lot of fun. Not quite as challenging as Black Box is, but it can be a little bit nerve-wracking because you're trying to think, what is the right answer? And it's not often clear which answer is the quote-unquote right answer. I think there are really, ultimately, there are no really right or wrong answers. It just depends on how long you get to play any one round of the game before you actually get to one of those 52 different endings. The challenge, I guess, is going to be to figure out how to unlock all of the 52 different endings. You also get some additional challenges along the way, sort of level challenges to try and accomplish too. So you can work your answers towards those kinds of challenges as well. But check it out, Artificial Superintelligence. That is my thing of the moment for this week, and with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of TextExpander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also TextExpander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all of their great software and get more information by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. That's the right phone number. You can leave your voicemail there, and I look forward to hearing from you. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, along with links, you can find those at maccast.com, and while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. Great place to get help with your technical questions. Check it out. And if you need to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community, google.com/plusmaccast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.